help them. And greatly appreciate their support. John Garcia from the California Community Foundation was scheduled to be with us and had an emergency out of state at the last minute. So we aren't able to thank him in person, but we certainly appreciate his help. And I especially want to acknowledge Lori Russman.
Oh, please. Yeah.
As everyone in this room knows, we would not be here were it not for Lori. So thank you, Lori, for all of that. She's actually a very talented filmmaker, but she's also somebody very dedicated to civil rights, and so she's doing civil rights with us. I just got a note, just a very, very short time ago, about a TESOL quarterly that Lisa and Claudia are co-editing, and so I just want to raise that with you. The abstracts will be in January. We're going to make copies of the call and put it out tomorrow, but just so you know about it, because it is exactly on this topic. So, just an alert. And I want to thank each of you for being here, because I know how busy your schedules is. I know this required a real commitment on your part to be able to be here, and we very much appreciate it. We had a very hard cap on how many people we could invite. So each of you was selected as an expert in your field. There's a reason why every one of those invitations went out to the people that they did. And we expect a thoughtful and candid set of reflections over the next day and a half. And finally, I want to introduce three graduate students who will be with us taking notes and keeping time. So there will be no taking going on the entire time, and they will be helping us with timing. And is Christine? Are they here? Oh, Christine and Clemens, right? And Olivia Oreso. Is Olivia here?
She'll be here.
Okay. So there are three of our graduate students here at UCLA, and we get wonderful, wonderful graduate students, and they're all very interested in this topic. So. They will be taking very copious notes. I also want to mention a couple of program changes. Rosa Molina will be leading us off with Catherine and Holmberry's paper, because Catherine had a medical emergency at the last minute. So I want you to all keep her in your hearts and in your minds that she's doing well. But Rosa was really gracious in stepping in for that. Catherine had completed her paper. Lugali Lavadens and will be presenting tomorrow before lunch, and Deb Palmer changing will be presenting after lunch. This was a very last minute thing, so we weren't able to change the program, so I'm just letting you know to do that flip on the program. Okay, I want to say a couple words about how we got here. How did this all come about? Some of us from the coordinating committee all met in Washington, D.C. some months back. And all individuals who were deeply committed to dual language education. And we began discussing at that meeting our concerns that we really needed to get this right. That we would be passing up a great opportunity to do some really good things if we don't get it right. And we took very seriously the concerns about equity that Guadalupe Valdez had raised for us two decades ago and continues to raise for us. And yet those concerns remain unresolved and we would argue insufficiently explored. So that's what we're here to do. I want to say also at this moment a couple words about why I am here. My research career, which has been rather lengthy now, has been in the area of education policy, which means I think a lot about the macro effects of different educational policies and their connection to social policy. My research has had two major lines or strands. One is greater access to educational opportunity for underrepresented students, especially Latinos, And as a result of that rather lengthy kind of research, I have concluded that separate cannot ever be equal. The second strand has been access to the full development of native language skills, which for too long have been devalued, denigrated, and even as we know that they are critical assets for the children of immigrants. So, with increasing income inequality, decreasing access to housing in neighborhoods with strong schools, and with conservative courts that continue to limit our tools to integrate the schools, I believe that well-implemented, two-way, dual-language immersion programs can provide the opportunity to address both of those, to integrate the students from very different backgrounds, and to fully develop non-English languages for emergent bilingual students, as well as their peers. Perhaps for the first time, helping people to truly value the language assets that we have been squandering. So I personally feel very strongly that we need to get this right. Although we won't get into this issue at this conference, it's also important to keep in mind that the students we call emerging bilinguals are also the children of immigrants. And many are under attack by this anti-immigrant government that is terrorizing their parents and making it nearly impossible to take full advantage of any educational offerings. We can't get into that here, but I would hope that you would all hold that in your minds as we think about how we create equitable situations, because these children are in very inequitable situations, even before we talk about the language instruction. So our goals for this conference are, one, to establish where we are today with two-way dual language immersion. Two, to identify the critical areas of equity concerns, including equity for all population groups, including African Americans and others. And in doing that, to issue stereotypes about who these groups are. I think we tend to have rather fixed notions about who we're talking about when we say Latinos, African Americans, white kids. I think we have to put that aside and realize that there is great diversity in all of these groups, and all of these children deserve an equitable education. And how are we going to forge that? Three, to begin a sustained and open dialogue among researchers and practitioners around equity in dual language instruction. We want this to be the beginning of a real open conversation. Four, to figure out how to more effectively disseminate information about equity issues. And it looks like our colleagues here are on to that with the TESOL quarterly piece that they'll be, well, the whole issue, special issue that they'll be doing. So that's a really important piece here, addition, to let people know about that. And finally, to engage philanthropy to help us to get it right. Those are our goals. It's a tall order, but we think we have the right people in the room for the job. So, a couple words about the rules of engagement. We want you to feel free to move around, get snacks, use the restroom, get up as you need to. We have a couple breaks built in, but please feel comfortable. We have scheduled significant time for discussion. We want this to be a conversation that is stimulated by the papers, but not overly driven by the papers. So we will be strict about keeping presentations to the time allotted. Everybody who knows me knows I'm really a stickler for this. We pull people off if they're going over. Likewise, we want everyone in this room to be involved. So we appreciate, during the conversation periods, that you keep your comments succinct and give the floor to others so that we can hear from everyone. Moderators are already prepped. for moving the conversation on to give everyone a chance to engage should it tend to get stuck. Now, finally, so that we all know who is in the room, I'm going to ask you, as we go around, to give your name, your affiliation, and one short sentence or description of what it is you do. And I'm going to model that by saying, my name is Patricia Nandra. I am at UCLA, and I'm co-director of the Civil Rights Project for the Derechos de Youth. That's it. We could go around the room so that everybody knows who they are in the company of. So why don't we start with Michelle?
Good afternoon, everybody. Shelley Spiegel Coleman. I'm the executive director of Californians Together. Pleasure to be here.
Hello, everybody. I'm Magali Lamadens. I'm professor in Department of Ed Leadership and the executive director of the Center for Equity for English Learners at Loyola Marymount University.
Hi, my name is Dory A. I'm an assistant professor in the Special Rights Programs in Urban Education Department at Loyola Marymount University.
I'm Dick Brecht. I'm from the American Council for International Education, and I'm co-director of the research center there.
I'm Nelson Pilates. I'm an associate professor of educational linguistics at the University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, I'm Marianne Willis. I am a mom. I'm a parent in Inglewood Unified School District.
Hi, I'm Brittany McKinnon, Integrated Schools, and we are an organization of parents who are joyfully sending our kids to integrated schools.
Hi, I'm Tara Fortune, and I work at Carlin University of Minnesota, and I direct the immersion projects there.
And I'm Lydia Corsi-Steven, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Multicultural Education Department with Valley University.
Good afternoon, I'm Hilda Maldonado. I'm Senior Executive Director of Diversity and Instruction at the Office of the Superintendent of the San Diego Unified School District.
I'm Judy Kroll. I'm on the faculty at UC Riverside in psychology, and I study the way second language learning and bilingualism changes minds and learners.
So, Esther, why don't we start here?
I'm Esther de Jong. I'm a professor in public education and English as a second language. I'm also the director for the School of Teaching and Learning at the College of Education at the University of Florida.
I am Ophelia Wade. I am representing the National Council of State Supervisors for Languages.
I'm Greg Roberts, American Councils, and I'm the director of the Language Immersion Studies.
I'm John Valentine. I'm with Gwinnett County Public Schools and in Georgia, outside of Atlanta, and I'm the director of World Languages and World Language Learning.
Hi, everybody. My name is Susan Eaton, and I'm a professor of practice at the Public School for Social Policy, which is at Brandeis. I teach core courses there on immigration and on education, and I also direct the Stillman Center for the Advancement of Social Justice.
Hello, everybody. I'm Johanna Luxemburg. I'm with the University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, I'm Connor Williams. I was the founding director of the Dual Language Learners National Work Group in New America, and now I'm a fellow at the Center Foundation.
Hello, everyone. I'm Guadalupe Valdez. I'm a professor of education at Stanford University.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rosa Molina. I'm the executive director of the Association of Two-Way Dual Language Education.
Hi, I'm Donna Christian. I'm a senior fellow with the Center for Applied Linguistics.
Hello, I'm Lisa Dorner, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the University of Missouri, and also a proud parent of two kids who have gone through language immersion schooling.
Hello, everyone. I am Chavez Kumar-Kasun, Associate Professor of Bilingual Education at Arizona State University.
I'm Lisa Tabaku, and I'm at the Center for Applied Linguistics. My title is Director Global Language and Cultures. My main function is to interpret the research to help programs evolve or start new language programs.
I'm Michael Bacon. I'm from Public Schools, a director of the Department of Dual Language.
I'm Ilana Umansky. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Oregon. I study education policy.
I am Deb Palmer, and Professor of Educational Equity and Cultural Diversity at the University of Colorado Boulder.
I'm Francesca Lopez. I'm a professor at the University of Arizona in the Educational Policy Studies Department.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Stackhouse, Texas A&M University, and my research interests are teacher preparation and keeping teachers in the classroom for longer times.
Hi, I'm Liz Howard, and I'm an associate professor of bilingual education at the University of Connecticut.
Good afternoon. I'm Anna Hernandez, and I am associate professor of multilingual multicultural education at California State University, San Marcos.
My sister campus. I'm Cristina Alfaro from San Diego State University. I'm a professor there, and with a directorship in bilingual teacher education.
And I'm Bob Slater, co-director of American Council's Research Center, and I do research.
There are so many things I could say about each of you that I know. I am so, so excited. I can't tell you. This is the most incredible group in this room. I think we have assembled for just about anything. So I hope you, after hearing who your socios are here in this room, are as excited as I am about bringing this group together. We're going to move on to staying right on time here with Dick Brett and my partner here, Bob Slater, are going to be presenting on an overview, the state of dual language immersion education. And they're going to divide this up, the presentation, so I'll let them figure out how they're going to do that.
So do I get your 7 minutes?
No. We're keeping those in the bank.
I come from Washington, where I'm from Foxy. I see your 7 minutes. And this is, let me echo what Patricia just said. This is quite a group. I hope to be able to help set the bit of the tone for what we're going to talk about today and tomorrow, and issue enough challenges to the group that can get us off to a good start. I'm going to provide a bit of a view from maybe 50,000 feet, maybe 35,000 feet, a macro view of some of the key research trends and trends of dual language immersion education, some with and some without the equity lens. I'm not going to repeat a lot in the paper. You can read the paper. And when I always do notes, I get bored with the paper that we wrote, so I try to think a little beyond it, and that often gets me in trouble. I'm also uncharacteristically going to stick to my script so I don't go off note and take too much time. I take responsibility for most of what I'm going to say. I am, at about 15 minutes into this, going to turn it over to my colleague, Dick Brett, who's going to talk a bit about bilingualism. But I also want to acknowledge the inputs of my colleagues, Donna Christian and Greg Roberts, as we played with drafting this really difficult statement. So what do we know? Well, what we know is new language immersion is expanding rapidly across the country. How many programs? We can't say. There's no current effort to identify DLI programs. We guess that there are more than 2,500. We know that a number of states like Delaware, Georgia, North Carolina, Utah are rapidly expanding their programs across the state. We also know that new programs are popping up in predictable and unpredictable locations around the country. And we also know that California lurks over the next 10 years in terms of proliferation of programs. Worrisome is we don't know what kind of programs are being implemented. Two-way, one-way, 50-50, 90-10, where are the enrollments? What knowledge base, if any, are within school boards and administrators building upon successful models for dual language? To what population are they responding and initiating these programs? How aware are they of local and national dialogue, such as the dialogue that's about to take place here in the next day and a half? What we know is that what we do know is we've just begun to scratch the surface. in establishing a more rigorous and systematic research tradition, and that we have a long way to go. We know there's some anxiety about research, with worries that the results might identify issues and problems. There are implications for how we do our research and how we make sure it's relevant and makes a difference. That's something I'll return to at the end of my remarks. But we focus on three primary areas in the paper: academic outcomes, biliteracy and bilingualism, and socio and behavioral development. And we finish very briefly with a report that's in the paper on results of a rather unscientific survey with 32 DLI administrators concerning what they see as the most important issues regarding equity in DLI. So, academic outcomes. Our paper briefly outlines some of the more recent and important research that explores the relationship between DLI and academic outcomes. But it's important to put this more current research into the context of research that has informed the field. It follows a period of research that gained prominence in the late 90s and early 2000s that tended toward some sweeping generalization arguments about in what I would call, and quote, the astounding effectiveness of dual language education for all, quoting Thomas and colleagues in 2004. Some of the research was characterized by a lack of rigor in research design and implementation. There were often no comparisons between treatment groups, no longitudinal analysis, no statistical controls for models that relied on non-random assignment. It's led to some conclusions that one critic of the research wrote a paper entitled Mystery on the Bilingual Express. Why is this early research so important? It established in the minds of some that dual language education programs could be thought of as synonymous with better academic outcomes. In many fortunate ways, it told everyone what they wanted to hear. And I use an example of the kinds of statements that come out even from organizations that are well-placed and responsible, like NABE, who released a statement about DLI just a week or two ago. It says, overwhelming research clearly demonstrates that dual language immersion is the most effective instructional program for educating ELL students. DLI can easily be adopted as the district or school's bilingual education program serving only ELLs. DLI programs, quote, close the achievement gap, increase graduation rates, and reduce having long-term ELLs. Do we really know this? Or are there more cautionary signals worth acknowledging? Contemporary research has now begun to address some of these issues. It's fueled by an experienced and somewhat younger group of researchers and methodologists, some from the education field and some from econometrics and other research methodology fields. I've had the pleasure, for example, of working with Jennifer Steele. Jennifer, when we started on the Portland study 8 years ago, knew nothing about dual language education. And now she can sit with a group like this and talk like an expert, but she's an econometrician. So Jennifer, we have Alana here, her mentor, Sean Reardon, Andrew Bibler from the University of Alaska. They're establishing a really important effort in research that has a common commitment to a more rigorous methodology and a thorough understanding of the limitations that might be imposed on making broad generalizations. What we've learned from these studies is, for example, and cited in the paper, Mansky and Reardon talk about, from a longitudinal analysis of Latinx ELs placed in two-way Spanish immersions, were reclassified from English learner to English proficient status more slowly in elementary school, but at higher rates by high school. Valentino and Reardon, 2015, said ELs placed in DLI in kindergarten initially performed lower in English language arts than those placed in short-term or long-term bilingual education or in monolingual classrooms, but they showed stronger growth in English language arts performance between second and seventh grade than those placed in other types of programs. They found long-term benefits of DLI relative to English-only education and English language arts and math. I had the honor and pleasure of working on the major study in Portland. One of the only random assignment studies in new language immersion, made possible because the Portland public school system assigned most of their DLI seats through a lottery, demand exceeded supply, so there were winners and losers, and they maintain well-documented records, along with a willingness to make all of their data available with considerable risk. We found positive effects in reading and English of about 7 months of learning in fifth grade and 9 months in eighth grade. Effects were statistically similar regardless of classroom language, student's native language, program type, one-way, two-way, 90-10, 50-50. Additionally, ELs randomly assigned to immersion had higher rates of English proficiency by sixth grade. But even with those as examples of research, we have enormous gaps that need to be addressed. Very limited controls for differential effects by race, ethnicity, or other factors such as poverty. Selection bias remains an enormous problem with these programs. Very little longitudinal work and almost no cross-sectional work. Testing in English makes it difficult to assess the role of proficiency in the partner language, other than by assuming a degree of bilingualism based on the curriculum offered. And as we all know in some of the other papers cited, African Americans are not studied at all. We have no idea about secondary school impact. We have very little idea about retention. We have very little idea about academic achievement in high school and college attainment. So those are all critical areas. So there's a lot to do with research, and we can talk about that later. In addition, I want to spend a little time talking about socio-emotional development. Why? Because it provides, and interestingly, it has not been a centerpiece of discussion in dual language immersion. It provides an important contemporary approach to child development in dual language immersion. I would argue that socio-emotional learning is inclusive of what for many years we have called cross-cultural learning. What is it? It's defined as the process through which children and adults acquire and effectively apply the knowledge, attitudes, and skills necessary to understand and manage emotions, set and achieve positive goals, feel and show empathy for others, establish and maintain positive relationships, and make responsible decisions. How is it related to dual language immersion and what we're talking about today? Many at-risk students, including those from racial, cultural, and linguistic backgrounds, refugees, immigrants, adoptees, U.S.-born children of non-English speakers, often share common experiences of isolation, discrimination, and acculturation, all of which negatively impact on socio-emotional and emotional development. Programs that serve these students, including DLI programs, rarely focus directly on self-efficacy, social inclusion, and independence. Instead, they emphasize English acquisition and proficiency in a partner language. Our field is ripe for innovation and creation of better approaches to socio-emotional development. Evidence does suggest that use of a child's home language in the classroom encourages closer relationships between teachers and students, promoting better behaviors in the classroom. Children who are learning two languages may need to negotiate between two competing sets of cultural expectations that have distinctive goals for behavior relevant to socio-emotional development. There's limited evidence, but only from dual language learner field, not from DLI, that social behavioral competence of DLL children in preschool and elementary school settings is higher than that of their monolingual peers. The Center for Early Care and Education Research reports evidence that use of the home language by early childhood educators may have a positive effect on learners' behavioral regulation. This is important as socio-emotional skills such as conscientiousness, resilience, empathy, self-control have been found to play a prominent role in shaping academic and long-term outcomes. We also have evidence from cognitive science, some of which we'll talk about, that children who encounter two languages on a daily basis present enhanced development of their inhibitory control and attention abilities. Much of the ambiguity on how to address social-emotional needs, like the ones in the DLI classroom, stem from a lack of research on the relationship between socio-emotional learning and DLI. It makes logical sense that we need to look more at this. Both approaches are important to an understanding of how the classroom in DLI might take better advantage of the bilingual environment and empower more students to develop the skills they need to succeed. Interestingly, a colleague told me, who works in socio-emotional learning, that in an ACFL 2016 meeting, there was a notable incident during a conversation about fostering empathy in intercultural education. Is empathy something can be taught? In this discussion, an individual called out, well, you cannot teach empathy. Is that the case? So socio-emotional learning is an approach that suggests, quite to the contrary, that the classroom, particularly in perhaps the DLI classroom, is the perfect place. We're also moving forward on the development of more valid approaches to measure SEL. Historically, it's been a subjective rating scheme by teachers, but we're now moving to better instruments with web-based systems that offer more objective approaches. So I think that's as we talk about equity in the classroom, and we talk about the development of skills and understanding better what can happen in the classroom, which people talk about a fourth stool. I don't know whether it's the fourth leg of the stool or whether it's got five legs, although I've not seen too many stools with five legs. I think that's an important one that needs to be injected into the conversation right now. I'm going to turn it over to Dick to talk about bilingualism, and then I'll come back to report very briefly on some of the findings from our survey.
I'm going to try to say less so you understand more. What we need now is to understand who the bilinguals are in dual language immersion. It is time now, and we're prepared now, not to try to evaluate dual language students against non-dual language students. Our job is to understand dual language students within dual language immersion education. We need to understand who succeeds and who doesn't, and we need to understand the causes of that. At this stage, if we don't understand the cause of dual language immersion, which is predicated on bilingualism affects executive function, affects education, achievement, and attainment. We don't know the connection between bilingualism and the cognitive basis of it. That's our problem. And what we need now to do is merge the research, the quantitative research that Bob has described, with the cognitive researchers who are trying to understand the brain by using bilingualism as the laboratory for understanding how the brain works. And they need to understand bilingualism in order to proceed with that. And finally, we need to merge those two language traditions, research traditions, with the traditions, the qualitative, and the traditions of Guadalupe, and all of you in this room, or most of you in this room, that you're going to hear about. Those three traditions are critical in seeing the whole perspective of trying now to understand what is a bilingual, how much bilingualism gives you cognitive advantages, and what about bilingualism? What do we know about it? And how do we investigate a little bit more? So I'll just say, why do we stop at correlations? The correlation does not show why. The correlation does not show who succeeds and who doesn't succeed in dual language immersion. And it's very likely that there are high succeeders, and low succeeders. And that combination leaves out the low ones to the advantage of the high ones. We don't know that. And unless we look at this, we also don't know all the variables. We can't control all of the variables of dual language versus non-dual language. A brilliant article, 1982, Hakata and Diaz. Read the article now and you will understand everything we need to know now to go forward. And they did it in 1982. It's a brilliant article and does a lot better than I'm doing. So, and I have just one axe. Right now, in cognitive science, it's about usage and exposure. The definition of a bilingual is how much they use, how much they're exposed, and under what circumstances, in what context they are exposed and used. This is critical. This brings it all together, along with SL, along with what Bob just mentioned now in SEL and so on. It's the context of usage, it's the amount of usage and the amount of exposure that will define these bilinguals, will define categories of bilinguals, so there will be some hope in establishing a correlation between that category of bilingual of this one has operated in a code switching, in a translanguaging environment for X number of years, and this person is a monolingual who's been in the classroom for a little bit or 10 years and a totally different school and environment. Until we separate those, we do not know what is bilingualism, and we do not know how to correlate that with educational achievement. And there's one thing I want to talk, 1 minute and I'll stop. It has to do with usage. Usage, if you go back to the original characterization of Grant and the economists studying language, they talk about the richness of heritage has to do with COD, has to do with the competence, proficiency of users, it has to do with the opportunities these users have, and it has to do with the motivation that these users bring to use those opportunities. If we're going to now, for the first time, study usage and exposure, we have to study the proficiency that they need in order to take advantage of the opportunities they have or don't have, and the motivation they have or don't have to take advantage of the opportunities with the competence they have. That's all we have to do right at the moment. And right at the moment, we're capable of that because we have these three research traditions. We have the quantitative, we have the wonderful naturalistic and the qualitative, and we have now the cognitive. Join the cognitive because they're focused on usage. We're focused on usage. They're focused on context. We're focused on context. We'll never address social justice until we understand how they're used, how bilinguals use language, how they learn to use language, how they and the context in which they do. Those are small variables. If you don't understand those, we don't understand any.
Okay, so do we have the slide with the questions? I'm going to finish up very quickly. There's a long piece at the end of the paper on the responses to the surveys. These are the questions. I'll let you look at the paper. We thought that one of the things we could do for this meeting was inject some general sense from the practitioner field about what they saw about equity. We know this isn't a scientific survey. We went and identified 82 administrators, not teachers, in the field. Sent out a survey with the following 7 questions, open-ended. I don't like Likert scales. I don't like any of that kind of stuff. So these were open-ended, gave them an opportunity to answer the questions. We got 32 responses, which I consider pretty good. That's 40%. Some of the respondents are actually here with us today, but we promised we would keep everybody's comments anonymous. They come from 23 states, rural and urban, large and small, immigrant, and or non-English speaking population. And I'm not going to try to summarize everything. It's in the paper, but I want to give you some general responses that should give us all some pause as we move through the next day and a half. General impression from the responses is that everybody everybody sort of recognizes that equity is an issue, perhaps a critical issue. But there's an enormous degree of uncertainty as to the depth and breadth of equity issues and their potential impact on the new language program. When asked to talk about the meaning of equity, most of the respondents emphasize the achievement gap in equal opportunity, closing the gap for Hispanic students, closing the achievement gap, access to immersion for all students. One respondent said moving beyond systemic racist practices of compliance and responsiveness, but there was an enormous diversity of responses. Concerns about equity, funding, gentrification, lack of curriculum and materials, absence of information for parents in the partner language, lack of transportation options, state assessments in English not aligning with research on second language acquisition. As we go down the list and dive a little deeper into some of these issues, there were fewer responses to those questions. To me, that indicates a certain correlation with depth of knowledge about the actual issues that were going on. It could reflect fatigue in answering the questions, although most people went through all six fairly thoroughly. Curriculum and materials, a third left it blank. But other responses talked about professionals lacking bilingual backgrounds, little experience with second language acquisition and immersion pedagogies, monolingual curriculum. Local control means that curriculum and materials are up to individual districts. Inherent cultural bias in curriculum material. Effective balance, I'm going to skip that one in the interest of time. Promoting equity. Responses really suggested less familiarity with it or how to promote equity. A number of responses indicate that state and local administrators are not terribly aware of equity issues. Others suggest little movement on addressing inequities in the school districts. Others talk about teachers, equity issues, for example, with international versus local teachers. I want to point out when we got to the other, there were very few responses. But since I have the advantage of knowing who responded to these questions, I will draw one conclusion that it would seem that there's a high correlation between the level of experience of the respondent in new language immersion and the thinking about equity as an important issue. One respondent said, and I quote, equity is a neglected lens in the DLI program. One main reason is that DLI decision makers, particularly at the school level, are often not well versed in the program itself, nor the deeper implications of equity issues, and therefore are not able to layer the equity lens using a well-informed framework. So what I want to close in is to leave us with an important point, I think. From the survey responses, from the research, from the experience in the field working with practitioners, in its early incarnations, new language was seen by many as a solution to the equity issue by promoting new opportunities for linguistically and culturally diverse students. It was enough. We did the dual language program, we implemented it, it's there, that's our solution to equity. And now we're all sitting here in this room for a day and a half and saying, that's not enough. And to a certain extent, that's a very threatening message to the practitioner field. So the survey responses make it clear to us that one of our major challenges is to translate the intense academic social justice and equity debate to a very experientially diverse practitioner field across the country who are striving as best they can to build and sustain these programs. And that, I think, is a very important message as we consider all the research, all the work we're going to talk about in the next day and a half about equity, is to consider the response and how we disseminate and accurately reflect solutions to the this very diverse, experientially diverse practitioner field. Okay, I'm done. And I'm within. Open up the floor and invite Dick and Donna and Greg and anybody else if you feel so moved to respond. So I don't respond to any at all. Question, comment? Somebody not doing any. See, this is what always when we start the meeting dynamics, always start this way.
I'll jump in.
Yeah.
So one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking about socio-emotional learning, I was thinking about, you know, we're at a point in our history, right, where we need to talk about race, where we need to have cross-cultural conversations. And it seems that dual language immersion classroom is a great space to do that, but I didn't hear that coming through in the way you talked about socio-emotional learning. That's really about cross-cultural competence and understanding the other, essentially. So how do you see that's been measured, if it's been measured before, in your opinion, by quantitative work? How do you see it's been studied in qualitative work, and how can we help teachers think about how to do that?
Well, that's a good question, because it's most of the socio-emotional learning field is now dealing with trying to equip teachers with the capacity to deliver that. It's not all about measurement, so of socio-emotional learning. And now that we have these new instruments that are available that make it a little easier and efficient and more cost effective to test, there's one, for example, I've worked with extensively, a researcher at Rush Institute in outside of Chicago, who's a neuroscientist, who developed a system called CellWeb, which is administered to young children in either English or Spanish. It's facial recognition, it's empathy, but now that his goal is to take the results and then work with teachers to determine, we don't have guides for teachers and methods. Now, it would seem to us that the dual language immersion classroom is the ideal environment to foster this kind of new approach to teaching in the classroom, because you've got this intercultural dynamic within the classroom. And so that, I don't know if that answers the question.
I don't know. Does anybody want to help me out?
Well, piggybacking on your comment. Could you, just for everybody, could you say your name when you comment so that we can put that in? Sorry. And
no,
thank you.
No problem. I'm Claudia Cervantes.
It also was very interesting to me that you used that term and the way that it was the way it was organized in your paper, you know, the academic outcomes and then the bilingual outcomes. But then the third goal, it's interesting to me because many years ago when I was a teacher and I heard about dual language education, the third goal was spoken about as being bicultural, right? So bilingual, bicultural, bilingual, biliterate, and bicultural. And that was a term that was used. And to me, as a teacher, who's, you know, all my students really were Latinx students, both my English dominant and Spanish dominant, and my bilinguals, and all of them were Latinos, right? And so, to me, it just fit right in, right? Being bicultural because they were, right? And so, fostering that and recognizing their biculturalism was an important piece to me. Then, as I moved in the field and through the years, then I started hearing a different term. Right now, it's cross-cultural, intercultural. So now, we're talking here about two different cultures crossing over, learning from each other. But now, as you speak about it in terms of social and emotional and behavior learning, it completely moves away from the cultural part. And what I'm hearing, you know, it sounds very cognitive, which places the attention on the individual cognitive activity that is happening, right? But it's almost losing complete focus on the cultural aspect of the program, which is something that was very powerful to me as a teacher. And I was wondering if you're seeing that move towards that. Is that something that you're seeing in the literature or in the and the research that we've been looking at, are we moving away from a focus or attention to culture and
I don't think
identity?
So. In fact, I would argue that the hypothesis is that biculturalism, affected biculturalism in the classroom, impacts on socio-emotional learning. And that might be a new dependent variable we look at. We have so much more evidence now about the relationship between socio-emotional learning and development of the child and academic outcomes for the child that we don't know whether the bicultural environment, particularly of the dual language classroom, is in fact related to that outcome. But it doesn't de-emphasize the bicultural at all, or any of the dynamics in the classroom. It makes the opposite argument, I think, that perhaps these elements in the classroom and in the teaching positively impact on social-emotional learning. So I don't think and if I put it that way, I was misleading. I don't think it replaces that. I think it's a new outcome that is something logical for us to look at in the development of the child. And so much emphasis is being put on that now in education. John?
Yeah, I'm John Downton. And I would just say, for those of us working on program design, it's something that we strive to do. But we're doing it through the lens of the content. So there's no extra time in the day. So we're working very, very hard to try to do that through math and through the social studies and through the work that we already have. So it's something that we're trying to learn from in the field. It is, I think your question is something we're losing, but we're trying very hard to do it. I think we probably need a little more help and a little more guidance in how to do it effectively.
Question.
I'm sorry.
How difficult, how are you measuring these things? And from whose culture is socio-emotional behavior being assessed? I think there's a slippery slope to culture and those values and not really, I mean, culture is a pretty complex thing. And I'm worried that you're looking at it from too shallow.
I don't know. A neuroscientist would quarrel with you and say there are maybe different approaches to how you build socio-emotional learning, but there are manifestations of it that are probably cross-cultural in terms of dealing with conflict or conflict mitigation, how you respond, and I can reference you to one of the instruments that's being used. It's reasonably, I'm not an expert in this yet, but it looks to be reasonably, quote, culturally sensitive to those issues, but I don't think it's a culturally biased measure. But the neuroscientists will argue on that one forever. Donna.
When I first saw that when we were talking about the paper, I thought of moving into the social emotional learning as taking us out a little bit from the cross-cultural, which to me is about how kids relate to others, and adding to that how they relate to themselves. So allowing for identity issues to be in there as well as relating to other people. So I sort of saw this as a broader way of moving us from just how these kids act with other people, but rather to allowing issues of identity, which I think have been being talked about more.
So I think there definitely is room for social emotional, which you discussed in your education. Speaking from bilingual teacher preparation, one of the things that we talk about that a lot, but what we really look at it is the way that we frame it, is looking at it from the development of students' social, cultural, and linguistic kinds of identity. Because if we're taking care of that, if that is the priority, then we take care of the social emotional aspect. So I think a lot of it has to do with how we frame it and looking at it so that we're not saying it's one or the other, but it's social emotional, but it's conditioned under social, cultural, and funds and identity, because that's what we're trying to develop in our students, is this very strong sense of identity based on their culture and
two comments related to the social emotional. My first thought was concern, I guess, about putting yet another, having it sound like yet another goal placed upon a program and practitioners and leaders of these programs that I think find themselves. My experience is that it's completely overwhelmed by the agenda, the number of hats there are to juggle and wear. So I think adding another, incorporating, I like what you were saying, Christine, because it makes more sense to me to try to incorporate this idea, and I was hearing from Donna as well, to it's really ultimately about definition of terms. We define the way of talking about identity development and cultural knowledge development, cross-cultural, self-understanding self as a cultural being, as well as other as cultural being, and growing an appreciation of that. But concern about adding a whole other layer of some, a whole other goal to the program, I think would be more effective with some. Broadening or and clarifying our definition to make it inclusive, I think, rather than to assess that whole other piece. And the second thing I was going to say in my work with teachers over many years is that a number of them have found a responsive classroom curriculum to be particularly helpful and very strongly have that sort of social and emotional development as a piece of that curriculum that they use during the morning meeting. So I would say that, working with immersion teachers who have taken that curriculum and then tried to map on how can you push language in there, how can you push cultural understanding in there, they found that to be a rich type of curriculum for them to be able to do that.
Let me just respond to the first point. And I'm not sitting here as an advocate for social emotional learning. What I'm sitting here is somebody who has spent a considerable amount of time studying that the sense of importance that this form of learning has taken on in education in general. And dual language immersion, like any other program, is an education program. It's not a dual language program. It exists within an educational environment. And so if this is now seen as a critical outcome of a child's development, and we put a renewed emphasis or a new emphasis on that kind of development of the child, then it's incumbent upon the dual language field, like any other program, to embrace that, study how it might be fostered, and actually consider that given the environment in that classroom, it may be a more ideal environment to foster that kind of development in other classrooms. That's the only argument. I'm not advocating that we burden the teacher with but to be honest, the teacher is going to be burdened with socio-emotional learning in most school systems, either now or very near in the future, because it has taken on a very, very prominent place in education in the United States, like it or not. So I think that's coming.
So, Michelle,
Shelley Spiegel-Holm. So I was taken aback by the way you started your presentation, reading the Nave pitch, and wondering because I mean in California we're like going at it like all over the place, right? They're just programs are blossoming all over the place, and everybody's doing them. You talk to them, they say because it's the only program that works, it's the best program, it has the research. I mean, so what is your thought about what we say?
I made that statement because I think it's important for this room to consider that over the day and a half. What is it we say?
Right.
And is it, be careful what you sell, because I've been saying for years in researching this field, if you make promises upon which you cannot deliver, it's death to these programs in the long run. People will ask, as these programs continue, particularly as potentially extend into middle school, high school, more and more penetrating questions will be asked about what these programs are accomplishing, so that what we say about these programs and what promises we make ought to be very carefully considered, how they're built up, how they're implemented, how they're supported, what administrators know, what school boards know, the promises they make to parents. This is all something that needs to be within the equity lens in this conversation here. Look at New York City as an example. 170 some odd programs in New York do language immersion in Bengali. So promises have made to students, parents, without curriculum, without trained teachers, and somehow there's going to be an effective dual language immersion in one way. So I am making a provocative statement. I think we're making a statement to this group about what is it we want to say, and what is it we want to promise, and how do we get from here where we are now to some point in the future where some of the issues that are going to be discussed in the next day and a half are we get more sophisticated in that discussion as we move ahead.
So I think the caveat we always say is when well implemented.
Yeah. When well implemented.
When well implemented.
When well implemented. I don't know what that means.
I'm not sure.
But again, I don't know what that means.
Connor. Yeah, Connor, I want to sharpen that point a little bit because I read the paper and I really enjoyed the presentation. I'm here because I think this is important. It's clear we need a better, refined research agenda about these programs. We can't say for sure, we're putting all our caveats about well implemented up front. But as the person who sits in the policy and politics space, let me just urge us that we have to have two tracks going the next day and a half, which is that there are questions we need to answer about what we know and what we need yet to know about how these programs work. And also we need to acknowledge these big structural forces around these programs politically, that this train is already out of the station. It left the station way back. We have to have a better research agenda, but we also need to be ready to talk next week, in fact, last week, about inequitable access to these programs. I get that we can't say everything we'd like to say about how these programs serve different groups of students, but that problem is happening already. And it is a problem. It's a problem for perception, even if we can't show in every possible way how it's a problem for long-term outcomes. But we have to have both these lenses ready today or again tomorrow. What our research agenda needs to look like, but also, where are we going to play politically? And what are we going to say?
I'm coming from a very different perspective. I'm a cognitive psychologist. I don't teach anybody except college students. And I want to address both the issue that you raised about the cognitive perspective being so separate from emotional issues, from cultural issues, from all of that. And I think that what's happened, and I think it's true, it's certainly true if you look at the literature, but I think that what's happened is that there is a recognition now that of course all of this has to be taken into account. It think we haven't had a choice to do that. And what's happened, what I see from your ISET, is that the research is beginning to really understand how things like social networks turn out to be really critical in language learning. And it's not just about context per se, it's about understanding who people and who kids and who adults are talking to and what the expectations are in those conversations, who their interlocutors are, what the discourse expectations are, how they come to predict what they can or cannot predict. And I guess I would also take issue with the idea that socio-emotional development is the outcome that we're after, rather than the context, the feature of the context, and the feature of the learning environment itself. And I think that it's very complicated to study all these things all together. And I think more and more, we're beginning to develop the tools and people are being, it's not been just the having the neuroscience tools, which are a fabulous, scary resource to have. But because you know, I mean, they're scary in the sense that none of us know everything about the center. And so you have to have teams of people work together who understand the agenda to be able to do this. But I think the other part of this is accepting the messiness of it and accepting the idea that these are not just, you know, simple kinds of research ideas that can be proposed and connected. And I just want to say, I have optimism. Obviously, I'm sitting here, and there are many people who are not sitting here today. But I think that I would be optimistic about saying that this next generation of researchers who are interested in trying to bring this together are beginning to embrace the variation we see and beginning to try to get a handle on how to really approach that. We're at a very early point of understanding that, and even the much earlier point of being able to apply it. And I guess one approach might be, and one thing that we might talk about in this time we have together, is how to create a discussion to think about how the kind of work that's actually done in dual language programs might inform this kind of research effort, so that it goes further.
Yeah, and maybe also to pick up on one of Judith's comments, we're already hamstrung because of our inability and much of our research by lack of the ability to randomly assign. I wish we were low stakes enough where we could say to parents, well, we need to study your children, so some get in and some don't get in, and we're going to randomly assign. Obviously, we know that doesn't work, so we can't do that. But we need more data. We need more access to students. We need more classrooms. We need more studies. There are lots of issues we need to address in the dual language classroom that, as researchers, we have not had access to over the years for a variety of reasons. It's another burden. It's another problem. It's another issue. It's obtrusive. When Michael will remember when we were in Portland doing our research, we did class observations. The teachers, by and large, were reasonably welcoming, but they were a pain in the neck. They didn't want us. We had graduate students coming. They didn't want our graduate students in their classrooms. And somehow they thought they were being, we had to disabuse them of the idea that we were evaluating that. We had no interest in evaluating teacher, but that kind of environment needs to change if we're going to get the new researchers involved in looking at some of these issues. Anyway. Michael?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to respond. I guess drawing on the prophetic cautionary note from one of the I just think we need to be very cautious about any new constructs that we bring in and remind ourselves that we are not working in a neutral context. That social and emotional learning, while very important, and I really appreciate that, in fact, but the fact that it's not going to be perhaps taken in the same way for a group of students as it will for another. Because we should be reminded, and Nelson reminds me of this, that language minoritized students have been constructed as psychologically and emotionally damaged. And so when we use these words, you know, these terms, we need to remember that we are talking about a group that, you know, this is not done in a vacuum. There's a whole historical discourse that has constructed children in a particular way, and that we need to be careful about not perpetuating that discourse, even when we are well-intended, right? But keeping in mind that this is not even cognitive science, as much as it does have to say and inform us, and it might be wonderful, but at the end of the day, when we translate that discourse into the context, we need to remember how our kids have been historically constructed and how those terms can serve to reify some of these ideas of our children. And so I just wanted to, you know,
I think that's caution. If I look at some of our goals that we stated at the beginning, one of the best, I don't know that it will come out of the day and a half, but it will start with the day and a half, is to come out and start defining how that research agenda, how that will look, and how to frame it in a way that responds to the issues you just read. Not just going into it thinking this is all neutral research, has no impact, has no interpretation other than it's all good. I think we need that lens to determine what the agenda needs to be going forward. Michael, did you have one?
Sure, Michael Bacon. from a practitioner standpoint, I pulled up an analysis we were doing across our city and all the programs and looking at what curriculum material we have and what holes we have. Unfortunately, some major holes. But one of the interesting content areas, believe it or not, that has popped up is social emotional learning and how it sort of just almost at the grassroots level, we have principals adopting and bringing something in, caring school for the toolbox. We got a bunch of them that are. And then they have not taken the time to even think about how that would be done in language, whether it is culturally, and I don't like to use the word culturally responsible, culturally sustainable pedagogy. So I think this is, whether it's research or not, it's hitting our world, and how do we bring that in a way that is really, I think, supportive of our emerging bilingual children, and not just supportive, but actually really done in a way linguistically, culturally, that is building up. And so I just put that out there because it is truly hitting our. And my worry is that it's another content area that I have to figure out how to support our principals and our teachers and how do you bring that in. And I worry that it takes the same pathway about language development that often is, oh, we're going to do ELD in just 30 minutes. Social emotional learning to me should actually be something just like language. It should be able to read throughout the entire day. I say ALD all day. All day, I think there probably should be social emotional learning support that is culturally and linguistically sustainable for our kids.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, I think that something that's implicit in this conversation is about the measures that are being used and how those measures are interpreted and then applied. So I think that there's a lot of hope in the kind of collaborations that our colleague mentioned here about constructing measures that really are more responsive, that are really more representative. So when we use a term like socio-emotional learning, recognizing that it's culturally laden and implicitly biased against students, again, whose cultures are not included in those measures. So I think that one of the areas that we may perhaps continue to talk about is what kinds of measures are being constructed or can be constructed, given the lack of those measures, to really uplift socio-emotional learning as a context that teachers, not just DLI teachers, are currently being faced with, but also that it looks and sounds and feels differently in the context of developing students who are bicultural, who have cross-cultural competencies and those kinds of elements that are, I'm pretty sure, not present in that literature because the measures
are... Yeah, I mean, as a researcher, I'd argue those are all hypotheticals. I don't have answers to any of those until they're studied, but those you just enumerated half a dozen hypotheses that need to be examined about that relate socio-emotional learning to the dual language classroom. And I would repeat something Judith said, it's not really the dependent variable here. There's something else going on. 5 minutes in the session. We won't overrun.
I just want to interject something here. I think there's also the possibility in this area to impair some of the damage by the kinds of research that we do. If the damage done to these children. Belinda and Reardon's paper on socio-emotional learning and early childhood education finds that actually minoritized children perform better in this area of socio-emotional learning, and it's the actual strength to build on for these kids. So I think we want to keep the balance there and considering how these things that could be used, and it's very important to raise that, could be used against the kids, can also be used in the future.
I'm Deb Palmer. Are we ready to shift a little bit? Because I have a different kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was really intrigued with your unscientific survey. what one of the things that came out in the responses, I mean, there were some really interesting, identifications of inequitable practices out there. But one of the things that came out was that not all the programs that these folks were talking about included emergent bilinguals in them.
Correct.
Right. So this brought to my mind the kind of the lack of information we have about what programs are out there, what the labels mean for each kind. And I was curious if you could just talk a little more about how you identified who sent it to, and then what came of that. Like later on, did you go, well, wait, that wasn't what we meant. We're looking for two-way language. Just talk about the process, the unscientific process of going through.
Yeah, that's why I said it was not scientific. Greg, you want to talk about that?
Yes, I'd like to be in trouble now. So I was the one that really identified the 82, and I knew going into this who was going to attend. So I tried to make sure I hit programs in your area, in your state, programs you work with. The issue is sometimes when we were working with districts, that they have multiple programs across the district. They might have a two-way, they might have a one-way. They might have even transitional bilingualism. They might have all kinds of different type of programs when you're dealing with the schools at the LEA. We also wanted to check what was the level of knowledge at some SEAs. So we sent some surveys out to SEA people to see what their knowledge was. And we also sent out to principals. So we really found all kinds of different programs. Like dug deep into California to find urban districts, rural districts. I reached into Philadelphia even to find schools in Philadelphia to send a survey to. I reached into all over parts of Arizona, Texas, Louisiana, down into Florida. I actually went to Missouri and found a school there. So I knew that I wanted to hit kind of really from A to Z. So these are not any one group you can really put into a group and identify. We have pretty much from A to Z in the survey. It was very different in who really answered. I didn't really see all the 32 where they came from. It would have been awesome if all 82 would have responded because it was a very diverse group.
But one thing that struck me about it, though, was that there, if anything, there were more folks responding with programs that were basically foreign language immersion than with programs that were maybe developmental bilingual or transitional.
I wanted to make sure I sent to places with more two-way programs. Maybe the one-way is one of the ones that responded, because that's when we responded. So I can share the list with you if you want to see the 82. No, I saw it, but it was very quite cross-representative. So it's not just the list of the 82 and 82. I'm not sure who the 32 responded to.
You know what it told me is? We need a better... What it underscored to me, I had very little hopes for this, honestly. It was an experiment. We put out 82 just randomly distributed surveys, got these responses back, read them. I thought the responses were really quite telling and fascinating, but I can't generalize. I can only report on a certain sense we got from them about, wow, this is really interesting. And I think for a number of the respondents, it's the first time they ever even thought about some of these questions.
So I just want to throw out there that we could call this science. Like, you specifically sent out to your social network by snowball sampling,
right,
you know, to as many two-way immersion, one-way immersion, language, dual language programs as possible, and then you got what you got. So you got 32 to respond. So a way to analyze the data that would be fascinating is actually look at what states responded, what kind of program did they have, what's their student population, and then look at the definitions of equity and how they talk about equity, and maybe we can learn something from that deeper qualitative analysis.
Precisely.
Of the data. So I think, I mean, maybe we want to think about this as scientific.
Yes,
and purposeful.
Absolutely.
And not just, it's just a you know, sense or a group of ideas. I think there's something that could be really rich.
And we had one minute.
I'm Rhonda Broussard. I think to follow up with Lisa's framing of what could be possible in analysis of this data and requires call for how we can do policy implications, these particular questions I thought were very thoughtful from an administrative level, district level, or school administration. But these are all the questions around governance. And so we think about who's making decisions at the school board level, what's happening for the PTO and the parent. I would hope that whoever does, who picks up the mantle for the next version of this, including all those policy and particular representation.
One last comment. We did have 5 superintendents on the survey. I don't know if they answered it. 5 superintendents. We did have 6 school board members. So we actually dedicated the three of us, but they were all administrative type people. But you know, we considered a superintendent for kindergarten school board members. So, you know, we should do it here.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay.
So
we're
going to have our last 3 attendees who were not here when we first introduced ourselves. And so I wanted to ask them to name your affiliation, and in less than 1 sentence, what did you do there? Rhonda, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Rhonda Broussard. In my previous life, I was a practitioner. I founded the Network of Language Immersion International Baccalaureate Schools in San Luis Obispo. I have been a classroom teacher for some years before that. Now I work with Bulletin Community, focuses more on sustainable equity in schools. So how do we get the practices done as far as operations, program, pedagogy, adult culture?
Thank you, Rhonda. Ursula.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ursula Aldana. I'm an assistant professor at the University of San Francisco, UCLA's alma mater. And I should also add the one interesting point about this. My children go to middle school. And are in middle school, and one is in middle school. And so I have obviously a lot of interest in this academically, but I can't help but also sit here also as a parent and really think critically about a lot of the questions you're asking.
And just before we have Nelson say something, I think that's really important because what you said, Ursula, because we do have some parents in the room who have been deeply, deeply engaged in this, and I want to ensure that their voices are also heard. I think we as researchers love to talk, and I don't want to overwhelm the experience and the contributions of those individuals who have been very carefully selected to be here, who've been engaged in actually doing the work. Nelson.
Oh, I introduced myself the first
time. Did you?
Oh,
I thought you were coming.
Well, if something else to say, you can get in a free sentence.
Okay, so everybody now has been introduced to the group, is that right?
Yes.
Obesso?
Hi, I'm Olivia Obesso. I'm a graduate student here at UCLA. I'm in my first year of a PhD program in urban schooling. I actually taught Spanish immersion for quite a few years, and I'm interested in the equitable implementation of dual language.
Fantastic. So we're ready to move on to our 330 panel. Great. Thank you.
The light is really blinding.
There are refreshments and sit back down. I'm going to be moderating this session, and I want to lead off. We're not doing elaborate introductions because you have the bios and the packets, and I think we all know each other pretty well anyway. But I do want to say that this paper in this session has been written by Catherine Lindholm-Leary, and I know that most of us know pretty well, but she is Professor Emerita of Child and Adolescent Development at San Jose State, where she taught for 28 years. And we all know that she has worked with programs all over the country, over 75 two-way and developmental bilingual programs in pre-K through 12, and is the author of many books, articles, research reviews, and important evaluation and research on dual language immersion in various forms. Unfortunately, as you heard, she's not able to be with us today, and so Rosa Molina has graciously agreed to offer her paper for us, provide the presentation, and Rosa is Executive Director of the Association of Two-Way and Dual Language Education, ATDLE, which evolved from Two-Way CABE, and she was involved with that as well. She came to that position after working in school districts for over 30 years, positions from teacher, principal, assistant superintendent, and so on. And I know Rosa from her days as principal at River Glen in San Jose, one of the early current incarnation of two-way immersion programs, and we worked together and loved it. And then I'm just going to also introduce Ana Menendez, who will be providing commentary and response, so that when we start, we can just keep going. Ana Menendez is Associate Professor and Program Coordinator of Multilingual and Multicultural Education in the School of Education at Cal State San Marcos. And her work is based on 32 years of teaching in California public schools as a bilingual dual language teacher in grades K through 8. And she currently does research examining instructional practices, teacher preparation, and cross-cultural equity in dual language education. The topic is DLI program planning and equity. And Rosa, you can
thank you.
Start. Thank you very much.
So good afternoon, everyone. And I am deeply saddened to be presenting this paper for Dr. Lynn O'Meara today because, given the seriousness of her illness, and I sincerely hope that I'll be able to step in and do it justice. So I'll need some latitude from all of you. Catherine and I have been colleagues for over 30 years as she designed, supported, and studied the implementation of the first two-way programs in California. Our school in San Jose eventually became one of the training sites for two-way immersion across the country, but it was her careful study of student progress in both languages, the analysis of the strengths and weaknesses of our implementation, and her ongoing support over the years that allowed my team of two-way teachers and myself to develop and expand our repertoire of effective instructional practices in working with students from our community, be it Spanish-speaking students, bilingual students, and English-only students. The basis of our work in California's dual language programs back in the day in San Francisco Unified, Santa Monica, Malibu, Oakland, San Diego, and San Jose in the mid-80s was deeply seated in a focus and commitment to the progress of Latino students. And we entered the work having had a successful track record in working with students whose first languages other than English, albeit within a failed transitional bilingual program model. And when the state of California invited districts to engage in this work and become demonstration sites in the implementation of a research-based two-way design, San Jose Unified raised its hand, and with it came some of the best bilingual educators in the district to initiate this model in our district. So after 30 years of study and with over 2,000 programs in the United States describing the programs as dual language immersion or two-way, Catherine Lynn O'Leary's research paper is both insightful and timely. Dr. Lynn O'Leary reviews and responds to the issues of equity from the perspective of research-based practices, best practices, and a clearly developed vision for bilingualism and biliteracy for educators engaged in this work. She outlines and describes the challenges and complexity required to do these programs well, and she outlines the pitfalls of doing this program poorly and what is at stake should students fail to meet the goals set out by this effort. She organized her paper around four major areas as she examines the practices that require practitioners and researchers to take note to ensure that goals set out by the program of bilingualism and biliteracy for all, the high academic achievement for program participants, and the development of pro-social and cross-cultural proficiencies will be realized for all student participants in an equitable, sustaining, and replicable endeavor. She describes this work within an additive bilingual context and knows only too well that when leaders and policymakers and researchers and district level educators are confused about what these programs are and can become, that they wreak havoc on student outcomes. Dr. Lindholm Leary outlines the need to frame and review programs from four different perspectives: administrative, programmatic implementation, school characteristics, and the demographics of the families and students being served in these programs. So I continue. After 30 years of both academic implementation and research on well-designed and carefully implemented programs, she is able to demonstrate positive impact of bilingualism on the student's linguistic, cognitive, and academic success. She finds that it is comparable or higher in terms of social-emotional outcomes, and she discusses the economic and career advantages derived from schooling in two or more languages as more and more cohorts complete their college education and work in the communities in which these programs are placed. The research also demonstrates the importance of ensuring that the effective programs promote high levels of bilingualism and biliteracy for all students in the program, requiring the program leaders, the school principals, and the teachers to work within a clear vision for bilingualism and biliteracy goals for all students in their respective communities. This is especially critical for students who enter the programs as English language learners or as native speakers of the target language, whose first language is at risk, and that requiring careful program implementation, reflective practices, culturally relevant curriculum, and carefully designed and intentional program practices. The native-speaking students of the target language are often relegated to practices set up by dominant language speakers and do not achieve the linguistic and academic and cultural goals, and that is of great concern to her. To all of us. So the academic and research on well-designed and carefully implemented programs demonstrate positive impact on bilingualism on students' linguistic, cognitive, and academic success. She finds that it is comparable or higher, that there's comparable or higher social emotional outcomes in the studies that she's conducted, and economic and career advantages. The research also demonstrates the importance of ensuring that the effective programs promote high levels of bilingualism and biliteracy for all students, and that students stay in the forefront of this work. The adults appear to get in the way. And so to work within a clear vision for bilingualism and biliteracy goals for all the students in their respective communities is especially critical for children who enter the program as native speakers, because it is their first language that's at risk, and this requires careful program development, reflective practices, culturally relevant curriculum, and carefully designed and intentional program practices. The native speaking students of the target language are often the ones that are most apt to fail in this system, and that is something that she takes forward and reminded all of us when we were implementing. Let's see what we're doing this year. Am I? Okay. Sorry. Lindholm Leary moves on to describing the great variances that exist throughout the United States within the programmatic characteristics of dual language programs. And she calls it a hodgepodge of implementation designs, instructional strategies and practices, assessments which may or may not be based on research and best practices. And she notes many studies reflecting on the student outcome in the name of dual language and finds that these programs are responsible for the poor performance of students in both languages and not only the native speakers. It is detrimental when these variances lead educators to design programs that are inconsistent with research and best practices, leading to low quality program implementation or narrow definitions that prevent schools from fully developing their models suited to meet the cultural, linguistic, and academic goals of the students from their communities. This is especially evident in programs that are full school efforts versus program strands, where the commitment to full implementation wanes as students move up the grade levels and they begin to struggle in the target language. She notes that the research on target language proficiency levels in 90-10 programs show great promise for native speakers and English fluent students, as compared to 50-50 programs, or what we refer to as partial immersion programs. And yet many districts exclusively adopt 50-50 models that promote English language proficiency and achievement data rather than achievement in both languages. Yet studies have examined whether the amount of primary language instruction is a significant factor in promoting the achievement of native speaking children. And it is clear in the research that the more foundational knowledge students have in the target language in the early years of their program experience, the stronger their motivation, their interest, and language development as they move into the critical years at the intermediate and secondary levels. Again, understanding that the students must be prepared linguistically for the curricular demands of the intermediate and secondary levels would lead one to believe that a stronger foundational experience in the target language would greatly benefit native speakers and English speakers as they move up the grade levels. And yet, policymakers opt for a program design that's not easy to implement in the name of simultaneous bilingualism and ensure that students will be able to achieve high levels of competency in both languages. And in summary, programs with a higher amount of instruction in the target language can lead to stronger proficiency in the partner language with no sacrifice to English proficiency, and many studies that she's conducted have actually brought that to bear. So she also talks about the importance of looking at the very basic selection of school sites when implementing new dual language programs. And when and she urges us to clearly consider that there needs to be clear consideration for the languages of the community, the cultures reflected in the program, the access to the program for families in and around the community. And this is what she refers to as key to ensuring equity of practice. A plan that clearly delineates the demographics, the interest in the second language, and the planning for diverse students and families is key to implementing a program that is both equitable and responsive to the needs of the community at large. Lindholm Leary points out that all facets of implementation need careful planning and serious consideration. And merely expressing interest in creating a dual language experience for students without careful consideration for all of the key components relegates the program to less than optimal practices. Selecting the school, staffing it appropriately, opening up enrollment for all students, selecting staff that is competent in the ability to lead, plan, and implement the program are just a few of the considerations. She notes the problems that occur when students are systematically kept out of the program for programmatic decisions, such as placement tests, the lack of communication in the family's home language, and lack of transportation options to actually support the inclusion of students, lower socioeconomic students, and ethnically diverse and linguistically diverse student populations. The selection criteria has become a bigger issue over the years than in the early years of implementation, because these programs in the early days were referred to as programs of choice, and that is no longer basic to the implementation of many, many of the programs across the country. In her final component, Lindholm Leary describes students and their families as being in the front and center of this effort. Across the country, there's a large variance in who participates in these programs and who makes the decisions about the academic preparation, linguistic capabilities, and maturity to participate in programs. If these programs are indeed programs of choice and were developed to be programs of choice, the choice belongs to the families, not to the school. And there must be an acknowledgement and understanding that student backgrounds matter and that this diversity enriches the program for all program participants. The funds of knowledge research is clear, and bringing forth families who have both the linguistic and culturally diverse understandings into this type of schooling creates an enriched and powerful learning opportunity for every student. Most English speakers in these programs are Euro-American, African-American, and Asian-Americans. And in some communities, the inclusion of English speakers from African-American backgrounds, for example, has raised the question of whether or not these children should even be included. While there's very little research on the literacy development of African-American students in both languages and poor English-speaking Latino students, there's enough evidence in disaggregated studies pertaining to these students that the students' growth in English is not adversely affected and may demonstrate higher levels of achievement and attitudes about schooling. Lin-Hung Leary urges programs to include students who are tested as fluent English speakers at the outset of their schooling. That's part of her paper where she talks about the inclusion of IFEPs, which in many districts, they're erroneously discouraged from participating because they've already been deemed fluent in English. So these bilingual students are amazing contributors to second language efforts in that they're often the language brokers, moving in and out of the language easily as they develop their literacy in both languages, and they should be included. Special considerations should also be made for students deemed special needs, and the inclusion of special needs students also calls for resources to be directed for the students to successfully develop their first language and second language and engage fully in these programs. These students need careful planning and support to ensure success, but it can be done, and it is being done in many parts of the country. So in closing, Catherine Lin-Hung Leary calls for careful examination of equity through the lens of well-planned programs that use research-based best practices to ensure success in two or more languages. Competencies in the academic, linguistic, and cultural advancement of students require carefully designed programs, and what she refers to as a clear vision for what bilingualism and biliteracy is for the community that they're serving.
Hi everyone, I'm Ana Hernandez, and I had the pleasure to talk to Catherine. She actually wrote the first paper, and that's the one I got to see.
This is the one you wrote.
And then she revised it, and we had a really great conversation about her paper. And one of the things that I asked her to really add was the administrative portion of it is we need to self-reflect more often and ask ourselves questions, why are we doing this? And things that are not working, why are we doing it? Why are we implementing them? What are the reasons for? What research is really informing our work? And so I was happy to see that she included some of these things that we both discussed over the phone. About program implementation, I have 36 years as a teacher, and 20 of those beautiful years I spent as a dual language teacher. And I can tell you the difference between, so I worked in three different school districts as a teacher. And I have to tell you that I told Catherine, staff morale is big when you're a teacher. And so to be careful when we place a lot of emphasis on the dual language program, there's only one strand at a school, that can affect the staff morale of the teachers implementing it, as well as the teachers who are on the outside, otherness, looking in, and to be really careful on how we position each other as teachers. I mean, we should be looked at as one school and a unity and a community of practice, not two separate schools within those particular program strands. I did talk to her about her student and her parent, and I said, you know, your paper really starts to be strong, but then I felt it was weak towards the end. She says, oh, I agree with you. I was running out of steam. And so she promised to include more in terms of that particular section, which is what I think I'm going to add this afternoon. We talked a great deal, too, about the lottery, the unfair lottery systems that we've been hearing about. But I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about something that I didn't find in her paper, and I did let her know, and I still didn't find it in the second revision, and I'll talk to Catherine more about it as she gets well and wants to proceed. But Thank you.
I just did it.
Yep, there we go. She pointed out four wonderful categories for equitable programs in dual language program, but what I'm going to really focus on in this part is programmatic, which is, I think, is what I'm most familiar with as a, my great background as a teacher in this area. And I picked up on this quote that I thought really encapsulated the paper for me. As she says, it is detrimental when the lack of definition leads educators to design programs that are inconsistent with research and best practices, leading to low quality programs, and when the definition is so narrow that a school cannot develop a different model that might better meet the needs of their culturally, linguistically, and socioeconomically diverse students, that meets the needs of their native speakers as well as the partner language and students that are native English speakers. I think that really put it in context for me, in that we do have this lack of definition. And I think that was mentioned earlier today, that we're progressing into this program without really defining some of the terminology that we're dealing with and some of the areas that we're working in. So she also states the importance of program sustainability with STEM-wide policies and practices, but operating without a vision for bilingualism can generally erode the support for the program and other design features. I want you to think about that. How do we put our programs together? We really tend to look at ratios a lot. Ratio of students, right? Identification labels of students. The location of programs to really appease the population that we are intending our programs to be for. We really have no consistency in how we allocate languages of instruction. And it is really sometimes based on very simple things like what materials we have in hand, what teachers want to teach, what subject areas, what is the intent of to lure certain populations into our programs. And those are really the basic little things that create our programs. We really are not looking at a bigger picture. So we need to create dual programs with much more in mind, such as examining and constantly reflecting on our biases, on our deficit thinking towards students and families of color that lead to how we shape our practices and who is included and excluded into our programs. Our own beliefs can act as barriers and gatekeepers on how students can access these programs that can be causes for really impeding democratic practices that are rooted in equity. And with that, I want to show you that we really are working and have been working for many years without really a framework that gives us a definition or a pathway or a light into what is equity. We all define equity very differently based on our backgrounds, based on our experiences, but we don't have a common language for equity in dual language education. And so I propose that we really need to self-question and reflect on our own practices to eradicate dominant perspectives, hegemonic discourses, and oppressive practices that impede an equitable implementation that should be free of injustices towards underrepresented students and families. And the second thing is to critically examine our own ideological perspectives about equity and what fosters our true sense of really being a community of practice, all of us together. That is absence of racist, political, and biased rhetoric that damages the fidelity and the implementation and our pedagogical clarity in our programs. So I really want us to, and I know we started the talk already on cross-cultural equity earlier this afternoon. And Catherine makes a clear case that the program designs really are, we need to revisit and really discuss the issues of equity around these four areas, administrative, programmatic, school, students, and families. But I found that there was an absence of guidance in defining cross-cultural competence, or if you want to call it equity, when planning and developing a program. And here is the growing problems. Cross-cultural competence, limited to surface level cultural understanding, little thought to our shared and diverse values and beliefs that deepen really our knowledge of our racial identities and our histories of discrimination, effects of white privilege, and even color blindness, which continue to build on the stereotypes of our students. So we need to really move away from these surface level, and I can tell you I'm guilty of it as a teacher, doing all the heroes and the holidays and the fun and the food and the festivals, and not really getting into the deep cultures of why we are here and why we are putting our programs forward. Also, the fast-growing problems of facing our students today are these misconceptions of culture that plague our schools and our communities, with biased manifestations of bullying and scapegoating. We only need to look at the television today and look at our politicians to know that we need to create a different generation that is resilient, that advocates, and that stands up for the rights of others. These are pure acts of social oppression, and we need to stop these as we talk about cross-cultural equity. So this third goal of cross-cultural equity is most of the time defined as accepting and being tolerant of others, appreciating self of understanding of others, learning about each other's cultures. But both children and teachers of color often deal with social stigma and oppression rather than a feeling of coalition building to balance an ethnic racial community. A dual language immersion program committed to planning for social justice is centered on cross-cultural equity at its core, not an afterthought. Educators need to mitigate these intercultural and interracial sensitivities through cross-cultural equity to build communities that are really dedicated to respect, peace, and equality. If we ignore one incident of prejudice in our classrooms, it threatens equity and justice in all of our communities. So, cross-cultural equity, what is it? In all of our minds, it's a different topic, right? Depends on our community. But these are biases against one individual. It could be based on race, ethnicity, gender, class, sexual orientation, exceptionality, language, and immigration status. Is detrimental to all our students, including the perpetrator. We view the world in our own identities through others' perceptions. We see ourselves through the looking glass of otherness. So I want you to think of cross-cultural equity as it is the ethics of caring. It is an inclusive community. Students and teachers are responsible for each other, and we should be able to call out injustices to ensure safe learning environments in all our schools. That should be the model for advocacy, for democracy, and for a positive collaborative interaction. There is no room for a hidden or intentional acts of that limit our students' potential. Prejudice is really an obstacle that prevents us from seeing others' abilities and gifts, possibly leading to discrimination and even tarnishing the spirit and the self-image of the most vulnerable populations that we have. To intentionally ignore cross-cultural equity in program planning can jeopardize building a compassionate and a respectful and a caring community for all of us. So we really need to pay attention to this third goal, but I urge you to think of it as the first goal. And this is something that I think it's good for us to talk about this next couple of days, because we can examine and we can reconstruct equity in our program planning at all our levels. And I like to advocate for not just cross-cultural equity for our students, but for our educators and certainly for our parents. And so I pose to you this afternoon to maybe define, and maybe this is the time for us to define, I'm just putting forward these four ideas here, to define our community of practice that should be an affirming cultural diversity, authentic and trusting relationships with others. And starting with placing language as our cultural tool. Because bilingualism and biliteracy are intertwined in our social, cultural, and social linguistic dispositions of students, educators, and parents. Learning a language is also learning a culture. So I want to leave you with this question here. Which cultures are invisible, voiceless, and or overlooked in our programs and community? The second thing is we need to be really socially conscious to ensure safe environments that model advocacy and democracy and positive collaborative interactions where students, educators, and parents will not be afraid to fully participate and call out any injustices. How are we grounding our programs to confront societal and institutional inequalities rooted in racism and classism? And the last two that I want you to think about this afternoon is to build a coalition building strategies that develop a community of practice that intersects with deep cultural ties with families and students to diminish the stereotypes and discrimination and truly appreciate the complex cultures, beliefs, and structures that they each bring and have. So how can teachers and students work together to eliminate prejudice in the classroom, the school, the institution, and the community? And the last one I want to leave you with is cross-cultural equity means reflective practices, continually examining our cultural relevant ways of teaching and learning through an equity lens that positions all our students at the center of our curriculum. Are we intentionally planning for teachers, students, and parents to become activists and advocates for social justice in our community? So I invite you to use these questions to engage in provocative discussion this afternoon or tomorrow before we leave. So that.
Okay, thanks, Rosa and Anna. Yeah, who knows what we'll come up because we'll have our discussion here now. I think we've heard some important discussion and comments about how we can do program planning and design with an eye towards the issues that we've been talking about. And the one thing that I think I would pull from that is thinking about what dual language immersion might be uniquely qualified to address in this area, and also what opportunities the idea of dual language immersion brings us for addressing some of these issues. Obviously, there are issues that belong to all of education and all of society, but the intersection of those issues with the promise of dual language immersion, I think, is something that we can fruitfully address. So I'd like to open it up if we have comments or questions, and we'll do our best if there are questions about Kathy's paper. Patricia?
I want to take a little bit different direction. I'll stand up. Kathy and I also communicated about her paper before this, she was unable to join us. And one of the areas that we agreed on very strongly and that Kathy had told me that she would be talking about is the issue of assessment. I think in the area of program planning and design, this is really, really important for us to not lose track of, because we measure what we care about. And we are not measuring the primary language. We are, even here in California, where we're getting very progressive on these issues, we've hit a wall on this, with people saying, well, it's just too much of a burden on the schools. If we're serious about truly creating biliteracy, then we have to know what it is that we are accomplishing or not. And
Kathy and I both agreed that we would go back to the State Board of Education with these issues and raise it again and again and again until we are heard that both languages need to be, if we're going to assess, okay, I'm not making an argument for assessing, I mean, that's another complicated issue, but to the extent to which we are assessing in one language, we must be assessing in both languages, otherwise, I think that that is a clear injustice, and it's a clear statement about how seriously we actually take the primary language. So I'd like that on the table.
In our informal, in another informal survey, we contacted 65 programs in California asking them to be part of an extended study on Spanish language achievement, and we've got information from only five that we're actually testing students at this point in Spanish. And so we talk about those assessments, and I wonder out loud is why do you have a program if you don't want to know how students are doing in both languages? It's as simple as that for us now. Greg?
Yeah, there are some states and some districts now that require partner language assessment and do pay for it.
Which states?
And I was just in Sacramento raising that conversation with the superintendent. Why is it that some states can actually pay for a partner language assessment, like in grades 3 through 9, just like they pay for English assessment? They should be paying for the partner language assessment. So the direction is moving that way for some states and some districts. I can name those, but I won't. But it is starting to happen because exactly what you said, why are we even have parents that raise this question? Why are we even putting our children into a dual language immersion program if we don't have any kind of assessment in the partner language? And so they're really raising it. So it has happened. Legislatures have actually made a required law of it. They've actually put funding towards paying for it. So it is happening and it's starting to happen more across the country.
Can I ask a question, Greg?
Where?
Is it part of the required standards or assessment? Because
yes.
That's also, some places do it, but they don't count it for anything.
In the accountability
it's
system.
It's kind of the whole thing. It's required, it's paid for, it's counted.
I know, but is it in the accountability system?
Yes, Johanna Watzinger. So I wanted to add to the discussion of proficiency assessment that if we just assess for proficiency, that's not really enough. It has to be put in the context of what are the overall goals, what is realistic, what can we realistically expect of programs in terms of the proficiency targets or goals that students achieve, and that comes back also to the 90-10-50-50 discussion. To me, that's the wrong question to ask. Is it 90-10 or 50-50? How much literacy instruction is there from grade 1 onward? And then what are the realistic goals for proficiency in that context? Because it's unrealistic to say 90-10 is where we get greater proficiency. We're going to have 50-50 programs. So the question for me is, what's realistic in these different contexts? Are we accomplishing these goals? And is there an iterative process once we have done the assessments to go back to the goals and benchmarks and say, what can we realistically expect? And that also goes back to what Connor said, how we're mitigating expectations, because the thinking is, oh yeah, the kids are going to be bilingual by sixth grade or by eighth grade. And of course that's not going to happen. So the proficiency assessment is also a important factor in setting goals and mitigating expectations.
But I think that the point she brings up about the 90-10s and 50-50s is really centered around English language learners and how English language learners are adversely affected by not developing into higher levels of proficiency in a language that's reasonably theirs. And so she's talking about literacy development for ELs. So when we look at this from the perspective of partial immersion programs for English speakers, that's a different qualifier than when you're talking about students who are native speakers and students who aren't developing higher levels of literacy. And we're seeing that kind of across the board in California when we look at assessments both in English and those that we can find in Spanish, is that we have English speakers outscoring Spanish speakers in a lot of these dual language programs, and that's a tremendous concern to us. So when we talk about the perspective that she's trying to raise, that she's raising it from the perspective of native speakers and bilingual kids who come in with language capabilities that aren't measured through standardized testing per se, The state test, but they're also not measured, they're not really taken into consideration that they also have targets and that we shouldn't be simplifying programs so that others advance and they don't. Mm-hmm. You know, that's her point.
I just have one question about the 90-10 versus 50-50. That's not in Catherine's paper and it's not been brought up in this group yet. Program design has a lot to do with equity of access. So since we know we have a severe teacher shortage in this country right now, 50-50 can double the number of students that have access. It doesn't matter if they're ELs or non-ELs. You double the number of students that have access. Around the country now, we have wait lists of 100,000 on these wait lists. And so by going with the single teacher 90-10 model, you're denying half of the kids in that school the ability to have access to this program. So there is a whole equity of access question around 90-10 versus 50-50, which was not brought up in their paper. And that's one reason why many districts have gone to 50-50 over 90-10, because the demand is so much greater than the supply, and they are able to double that supply by going to 50-50 versus 90-10.
Okay,
Ms.
McCauley?
Yes, so one of the things that I think that's important, an important policy consideration, is that when talking to state agencies about adopting and including a Spanish assessment, for example, in the accountability system, or even developing one that is widely adopted, is the cost. So she brings up a very interesting point, that citing other literature, that I think is a leverage point for policy in that the cost to implement a dual language program includes assessments, and the costs are also mitigated or supported by enhanced outcomes for students in academic achievement. So those relative costs are not as high as one would accept. It's on page 7 of her paper. So I think that's an interesting opportunity for us to continue in our ongoing conversations about the actual costs of all of the implementation features of dual language.
I think this question, as you just brought up, also goes back to what Connor said earlier about this assessment issue is really a matter of governance and policy and may not be within the purview of the local program design, but rather the broader what's allowed within the policies or what's made possible by the policies at higher levels.
So California has developed a Spanish assessment for language arts, but it's not comparable to the English one, and it's not part of the accountability system. So you can have an assessment, but if it doesn't count, like the English one counts, then what's the point?
Well, of course.
And so when we go around the state trying to augment and enhance the assessment and get the department in the state to include it in the accountability system, we have been talking to people across the state in districts saying, would you be willing to double test? And I'm not talking about people outside the programs, I'm talking about people inside the programs. They're not willing to double test. It's too much testing, right? They're like over the moon in testing, right? So the question is, we have a predicament, because actually we know what the cost would be. We know what the cost would be to augment the test. It's $3.5 million, and we only need $1.5 every year to do the scoring, the on-demand scoring. So that's not the issue for us. I mean, obviously we have to raise the money, but the real issue is those of us in the program, what are we willing to do to be able to document the bilingualism and biliteracy, and how do we have that conversation with the programs across the state?
Okay, we'll take two here first.
I just want to add two things about the assessment issue from where I sit. One of them is that there is a model that's emerging from the speech-language pathology literature, and there are a couple of people who have really been pioneers about taking on this assessment issue and arguing you can't just double test. You can't test using translation. You have to really develop a model of typical bilingual language development.
It's not a translation.
Right, and you need to really then say that they're going to look different in each language. And so that the evidence that's emerging really suggests that the interactions between languages are shaping both languages in ways that change what we take to be, you know, a particular level of achievement. The other thing I just want to say from the perspective of this other kind of language research that we do is that the native speaker model is now being blasted as well. It's very clear. There is a ton of research that shows that the idea that what we should be, what our goal should be, is to become a native-like speaker, monolingual native-like speaker, bilinguals, at second language learners, bilinguals, language learners need to be striving to become bilingual speakers of each language, because neither language looks like monolingual native-like languages. And that's really a pretty recent development in the literature and something that I think is going to radically change the way we think about assessment.
Okay. And my name is Joy E, and I think we need to have a more broader discussion by including other languages, because there are other non-Spanish speaking languages counting for language immersion programs. And I personally looked at Korean English immersion programs, and there's a growing demand, you know, Korean parents and non-Korean parents at the same time. They want to check, you know, how proficient their children, you know, become, you know, over time, especially for non-Korean parents. There is no way for them to check in, you know, I mean, to what extent, you know, their children, you know, became proficient in Korean. So there is a very informal, you know, assessment system within the program, but it's not comparable with, you know, statewide, you know, English, English art assessment and things like that. So I think we need to have more broad discussion by including not just the Spanish, but for other, you know, languages like Mandarin, Chinese, Korean, you know, not many programs.
Yes, that's certainly an important thing, and part of the many variables within any individual program that affect what can be done and what is done, and whether or not, I think talking about assessment is great. I would welcome any comments about other aspects of program design and equity, and certainly if we have more assessment that has to get out, that's fine. Guadalupe?
Guadalupe Valdez, and I just wanted to raise an issue of terminology. Some of you may have read the wonderful National Academy report that's titled Promoting the Educational Success of Children and Youth, etc., Promising Futures. And there, for the first time, they're using the term dual language learners, which I find very appealing, that they're talking about dual language learners. There are IFEPs, right? Yeah. So we look at them within the policy context in which we are, but that's often very, very misleading, because we really need to say, and I noticed that we're struggling with what to call them, whether we call them native speakers, whether we call them, what do we call them? So to even just admit the fact that it's confusing, that when we say, for example, and I love Ofelia Garcia, who started the emergent bilingual thing, but I don't like emergent bilingual, it's like you'll never get there. So I worry a lot about that, right? So we have to decide, in fact, what are we going to call these individuals? How can we categorize them without labeling them in ways that we do not mean to label them, as though there were not any room? So we have that dilemma. I don't have the solution. I just thought I'd raise the issue.
That's great. And certainly, yeah, thinking about terminology related to the linguistic profile of, you know, and the background and all of the kids is important. Rhonda, did you have your hand up?
I did. So the paper points out the really important questions around language of power. And how look at our programs and use, regardless of their family language or their own level of proficiency in the partner language, still tend to default to English as language of power in their interactions. And I wrote a question for myself, and I think it's a question for the room, it's a question for the research, around how in program design our professional development expectations are delivered in those target language, and the extent to which that impacts language of power for use. In our classrooms. So if our teachers, whether they are native speakers, whether they are heritage language speakers, bilinguals, et cetera, have access to their own adult professional development and training and teacher planning time in the language of instruction versus always defaulting to doing that in English and having to translate back for their students, what impact that has on language power and teaching.
I mean, we are going to have a session talking about teacher professional development. How much of the professional development and preparation of teachers is in the partner language so that they could be ready to use the partner language and in some ways equalize the power of the languages? work toward?
That is the golden question, because most districts do most of their training in English, and then the teachers have to translate all the materials and try to figure out how do you do this in the dual language context. It's a question that's out there, and we don't do the training at the district level in the primary language. And also the teachers need to practice the high level academic Spanish, not just the language of the materials, but how they need to do a lot of planning for language delivery, and that would really help.
I think we also have to remember that in California, we have a generation of teachers that were subjected to Proposition 227, which meant the elimination of language capability instruction for many, many of our teachers. And so a lot of our teachers are recapturing language, you know, as educators and trying to strengthen their capabilities. So it is really, it is of great importance to us as an organization, but also great importance to us in the network that our teachers, get the professional training in how to implement the program at the highest level that they can. But linguistically, many of our teachers are stretched as they're kind of learning language at the same time that they're teaching it, and that is a huge failing in, or a consequence as a result of what Proposition 227 did to us. And certainly in Arizona, where we're working with the programs that are currently under their mandate, 209, we see this in classroom after classroom, and the reduction of language capacity in our teachers is appalling. It is truly appalling. So that's been a big piece for us.
Also, I don't know about other states, but I know in California, about 66% of the teachers become bilingual teachers by just taking the exam.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So they're not getting methodology courses. We don't know their Spanish language proficiency. And so also there's no research done in this area to know how effective teachers who go through a teacher credential program are versus those that just take the exam and step into a classroom. So that's another big issue in terms of teacher preparation.
And that is certainly an issue for program planning, and a product of both the teacher shortage and the popularity and need for the programs coming together, so broadening the population of the range of teachers that would be accepted into a program.
Michael, did you
open Christina, and
yes, so just to add to what you were saying, you know, another thing that we have to consider is, you know, just teacher preparation programs in institutions of higher education, because first of all, getting the faculty that are bilingual, okay, and that have the proficiency, and what are we doing to work with that? That's one piece of it. The second piece is also having colleges of education that really support the development of the proficiency in the partner language. And then, what do those methods courses look like? Because, you know, one thing, yes, is taking the test, but also these methods courses that we offer, they're in English. It's for bilingual teachers, but yet every content area is in English. So then we look at these programs, and everybody gets a bilingual credential, but every program in every institution looks different. So there's no consistency in the way that we prepare teachers. I mean, this is just the content area, and then of course there's other aspects of it. But there's a lot of work to be done in the area. And then they get to school districts, and school districts feel, well, you have a bilingual credential, so you should be able to do this. And then they continue their professional development in English. So it's a systemic problem. So yes, we do have a lot of work to do.
Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna return to the point made about Korean, and what I was thinking, looking back and thinking about, and I really appreciate your comment about what our goal is, when we made a fundamental shift in our district around equity as the core of the strategic plan, and how that impacted all through the system over 9 years, 9 to 10 years of working through that, is our goal and our programs shifted from the classic three of, you know, academic achievement, you know, bilingual, bilateralism, cross-cultural, whatever you want to call that, to closing the opportunity gap, and equity is our goal. When we step back and start thinking about the languages that we have in our community in Portland, and certainly Spanish is the largest, but second largest is one that, quite frankly, personally, I myself overlooked, because I believe that we didn't think about the impact of how it gets commodified. I use the word commodified languages and cultures within the mainstream white culture or whatever, the empowered culture, not commodifying Vietnamese. And our reluctance to step into that because we didn't think people would want it. And I think about that from the equity lens and things about, you know, how do we really build those up, and, you know, how do we go out there? Here, right underneath our noses, we skipped right over Vietnamese. We went to Chinese and Russian instead, saying, my gosh, that's our second largest, and I'm going to switch terms. We used to say emerging bilinguals, but no language learners within our system, huge population. And we just skip right over that. And we had, not only within, you know, the key decision makers who didn't necessarily work Vietnamese heritage or whatever, but also within the Vietnamese community and not valuing and seeing that as something to, so I you know, something that they would want in their education for their own children. Not all, but certainly that was a something, an undercurrent we deal with and struggle with. So I just put that out there because I think that is an equity issue, that we jump right to languages that can be commodified rather than languages, instead of putting it centered on the student and the families and the communities and lifting those linguistic and cultural assets they have. So,
Thank you, Liz.
I have a question that's a little bit sideways. I'm Liz Howard, by the way. About who we're talking about when we're talking about equity, and, you know, because we've been talking a lot about, and most of the papers really focus a lot on racial ethnic characteristics of students and linguistic variation in the program, and so that's clearly front and center. But Kathy's paper also mentioned students with special learning needs, and that didn't come out as much to me in the other papers, and so I'm just wondering, is that on the table? Is that part of our mission to also talk about that, about those students and what equity means? Because to me, that's a really big piece of dual language equity, in terms of programs that screen sometimes, even getting access into them in the first place. Then once they're in, how are they supported? Lots of questions come up, I know, in programs about if it's a native English speaker in a 90-10 program, do you give them reading supplementation in English, or they're not getting English reading instruction at that time yet, or you do it in Spanish, that's a language of instruction. There's, you know, lots of questions that I hear, and then ultimately sometimes transitioning the children out, deciding that that's the best course of action. So, so that's just a question I have for the group, if we want to be, you know, focusing on that as well or not.
Yeah. Well, I think the student selection was brought up, and that's certainly an important part about whether, you know, whether you select them in and then how you plan for adequately serving their needs.
I was going to just make a general comment. Some of what I've heard in the last few minutes has mitigated a little of my concern. I mentioned this to Kathy when I read her paper, and I'm a little concerned that some of what we're talking about is at an abstract kind of Bill of Rights. I mean, everybody, what do we agree to are the equity issues? When we get down to, I was really happy when Patricia raised the issue of assessment, because I could see how everybody started to gravitate toward a concrete problem we have with inequity when we're talking about assessment. And then when you raise the issue, when Guadalupe raises the issue of what we call them, I mean, we have no common definition, and one district calls them one thing, another district calls them. There's no, we can't even get definitional clarity on what these students are. And then we talk about the what I would sort of classify and written as at-risk students, which extends far beyond, if Delaware's not represented here, but Delaware's looking at putting these programs in a predominantly poor white neighborhood in Wilmington, which they think would be a great idea to improve the academic opportunities for at-risk students that are not, they don't have a large non-native speaking English population in parts of Delaware. I think we need to get down to that. What I would like to challenge people to think about as we end today and move into tomorrow is moving more to the, I mean, Dick talked a little about we don't know what bilingual is. We give them a seal of biliteracy. We stamp them as bilingual. We don't. Particularly, I get to middle school and high school. What qualifies them? There's a study in the book you edited with your colleague at Texas on bilingual advantage, and we call them high use. What do we call them? They call them a chapter on college attainment. What's a high use bilingual? So I think there are a lot of specific questions we need to
bilingual in your book, and high use Hispanic bilingual succeeded remarkably. No definition whatsoever in any of those.
Well, I think Lucrecia will be able to answer that tomorrow.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was a huge data problem because nobody collects the data in order. So we have to make assumptions about usage being a proxy for a level of fluency or ability in the language because those data are not collected. But I'll let her defend that.
I want to
make a comment and take us back to what Anna told us today. And so one of the things that I want to thank Anna for doing is for pointing us in a direction that would say, if we wanted to change society, given where we are right now, what would you do in two-way immersion to cause that to happen? And she laid out an agenda for us with steps of saying, are we all about teaching language and making sure that you can now go and buy and sell across the world? Or is it that you relate to the society that's around you? And I really am moved by what you told us and hope that we won't let it drop. Assessment is very important. Program design is very important. But if we really don't think that we're building a world in our schools and that we might have a chance, because we do have parents that want their kids there, that maybe we want them to see each other as human beings in ways that we haven't been doing very well in American education. End of lecture.
Thank you.
You wanted to add something?
Yeah. I want to add something about assessment. I want to talk about program assessment, not student assessment. That if you take the GEPRA model, that the GEPRA model is assess inputs, process, outputs, and impact. Okay, we just heard you can define your impact. As if you define your impact, you can assess a program against, you know, that last thing, which is very important. If you want to evaluate teachers, you look at input. If you want to evaluate process, you look at sensitivities to cultures and classes and everything else and so on. Output, okay, there's a proficiency output or whatever you want to major on students and so on. There's another way, and it's all about setting standards, it's all about getting agreement on how you would evaluate a dual language immersion program if you wanted to set something that had an impact, as Guadalupe has just expressed, and you want to make sure that the outputs and the process and the input match that. And so it's another way of looking at it, just not the students. And, you know, and that gets, and once you start doing it that way, before you start defining impact, you've got to talk to parents. And there are a lot of other things you have to do. And I want to just add, I know it sounds naive, and I'm the naive one here without question, but it's also program assessment that maybe is more, is we can get it easier than assessing students against standards we don't believe in.
Shelley?
So the one piece that if Catherine were here, I was going to ask her about that she didn't address was the whole issue of pedagogy and what teachers do in the classroom. Because at least here in California, I won't speak for any place else, we have spent 20 years of doing scripted instruction, and we now do that in all kinds of languages, right? It wasn't limited to doing that bad instruction in English, right? We can do it poorly in a bunch of languages. And so teachers who are sitting in our classrooms who had to go through that, they really need a whole new set of pedagogy to begin to address what Guadalupe and Ana said, because it's how you teach that produces how children see the world, right? And so that is a huge, huge lift for us to think about for when we say when it's well implemented, because we've done some visits now to programs that have a good reputation, but when you walk in the classrooms, you cringe because of the pedagogy that's going on. So that's a huge issue for us. I don't know how you address it. Well, first of all, I have to do a disclaimer. My daughter, who is 31, had Anandas as a fourth grade teacher. And if you want to know about good pedagogy and bringing to life what she says here, you just have to watch her teach.
I'm Deb Plummer. So it kind of, I'd like to follow up a little on what Guadalupe said and bridge assessment to some of the other remarks that Ana made. First, the example of Texas. So Texas does have, its accountability system does have Spanish and English options, and teachers have to choose which one to use. So this does not solve anyone's problem, because it still does not provide a bilingual education. We get to choose English or Spanish. And the other piece is that bilinguals are not well assessed in either language by itself, isolated. Of course, they do need to master and learn and engage in those standard registers of language, but to really understand what they know about mathematics, we need to figure out assessment tools that assess bilingually. So at the heart of it is, well, in Texas, the teachers and administrators have the option to choose a Spanish or an English assessment, and they tend to choose English, regardless of the capacity of kids or how they perform better. It's the rare administrator who chooses Spanish assessments for their kids because of the dominance and the power from the English in society. And it's very well understood that ultimately these kids have to get to English because after sixth grade there are no Spanish assessments. So, the underlying it all is the ideologies that undergird our system, right? So if we're going to really think about how we create systems that support our bilingual learners, we really need to think, question our own ideologies. And it brings me right back to the slide that Anna had up at the very end there, which I was sad when it got blocked off. I wanted to like take a picture or something. So, we really need to think ideologically about our assessment or our accountability systems, because they're monoglossic, even if they're offered in two languages. And we really need to think ideologically about our own pedagogies and practices, because no matter whether we're in a program that allocates a lot of time or a little time to Spanish, we can articulate kids' hearts and souls and fund with knowledge and center those in the curriculum. And in through that route, as Guadalupe said, that could be our route to potentially transform our worlds. It seems like it's not so much about percentages as ideologies.
That may be a good note to end the day on. Patricia, do you?
Do we want to end right now?
Bob is. Okay.
Great. And I think it ties back to what Deborah just said. I think one of it is this notion of this vision for bilingualism, and we're assuming that that's not tongue tested. And I don't think it's the same vision. If I talk to the parents, they have a certain vision of what it means for them. If you talk to the students, it's a different vision. When we talk to our middle schoolers and high schoolers, there's a clear difference as to what the kids were looking for. And I think if you really respond to that, those visions, you do something very different in your program. And you assess very differently. So this kind of assumption that bilingualism means that you score well on whatever standardized test is in both languages, we completely miss out the vision of what bilingualism is. So I just want to make sure that we also kind of recognize that even that vision is very contested, it's not the same, and that we have all of the diverse students that we have in the programs that we've now been talking about, that vision may be very different. And we have, how do we capture that? And I liked what Nick was saying earlier in terms of saying, you know, maybe we should stop comparing. And remind me of Gary Chico's article way back in 1992 when he talked about bilingual education as necessity, possibility, and something or other. I wrote it out at some point. But the fact that, really think think about it, bilingualism, however defined, is what we think all children should achieve and accomplish. You don't have to compare them to anybody else. Then the question becomes, given the diversity of the students that we have, how do we get there? And the many different pathways that that will take, it won't be one. And so I just want to kind of put that out as part of the vision of bilingualism.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and that was something that I wondered about too, is are we bringing in the participants' views as we're talking about this, or are we saying what we think is best? I mean, I know everybody's talking to participants, but in a lot of cases, well, in some cases, participants may not be looking at the same goals as we might consider to be best for them or good for them. And so I think that is, you know, that's a very important part.
Yeah, Nelson. And I think part of the tension there, I think, is about different theories of language that I think are at tension in our field. I think there's an anthropological, linguistic kind of perspective that starts from the perspective that all people are socialized into complex language practices at home, and so to suggest that someone doesn't have a strong foundation is not, there's no linguistic basis for that. Mm-hmm. But then there's another theory of language in the field that kind of treats language as an entity that can be objectively assessed. And I think that there's oftentimes unspoken tensions between those theories of language in the field. And so oftentimes I think we end up contradicting ourselves in that we say we want to challenge deficit perspectives and we bring in all of this anthropological research that shows the complexities of language use, but then we continue to describe the students as not having strong foundations when we rely on assessment. So I think we really need to tease apart what exactly are we assessing with those assessments and how can we be precise with what we're saying, because we're not assessing proficiency in a general sense. The students are proficient in the language practices that they're socialized into at home. And I worry when we're too general and not precise enough that teachers then take up that discourse in ways that then we blame them for when we're the ones that are providing them, as researchers, I'm taking this research, we're the ones that are providing them with those discourses to use to describe the students to begin with. And so I think that's kind of a tension that I've noticed.
Can I make one comment too?
Sure. Tara.
One of the things, Tara, you know, I think I'm thinking about so many things that have been said, but I was compelled by Kathy's vision for bilingualism and biliteracy, really as sort of the foundational principle that I think her papers seem to keep going back to, that vision for bilingualism and biliteracy. And then I think about the power of the bilingual advantage work that really identified the importance of biliteracy as, and high levels of biliteracy, that as being really kind of a game changer for bilingual kids. The biliteracy is making a difference in terms of their realities and in terms of being able to open up additional opportunities and possibilities in their lives. So in those things argue, in my opinion, for keeping a close eye on what's happening in terms of bilingualism and biliteracy. We all know, anybody who's tried to measure anything, we don't measure academic achievement all that well, and we certainly measure bilingualism and biliteracy poorly. But to not measure it at all, and to not somehow come up with a gauge while the work is being done to come up with more effective measures, seems to me to not be keeping our eye on the prize. And I have a lot of concerns about the ways we market these programs around bilingualism and biliteracy as being the promised end goal, when I think we fall short more often than we would like. And that's particularly true in two ways with kids from English home language backgrounds. We fall short with that particular group in pretty astounding ways. that's a concern, and it relates to, this is the final thing that I will suggest, that issue of bilingualism and biliteracy, there's been a relationship drawn between the cognitive benefits that we, again, like to market the programs on, you know, the cognitive benefits that can accrue with bilingualism and biliteracy, but it has been established that they are connected to exactly how, we don't know exactly how high, but that there's a relationship between the level of bilingualism and biliteracy and these quote-unquote cognitive benefits. I feel like that's another huge black box for us, and I do have concerns about our overselling these programs, promising these high levels of bilingualism and biliteracy, which I wish we attained more, but better than we do, and then overpromising with the cognitive benefits, which are related to that.
And it certainly seems that with dual language immersion, the defining characteristic that separates it from all other educational programs is the use of two languages, because other programs could have designs that promote social justice within one language. I mean, it wouldn't be the same, but the defining feature of dual language is the use of two languages and the benefits or meeting the needs of a diverse set of population. It reminds me of the early 70s, the National Council of Teachers of English put out the statements about the students' right to their own language. And it was talking about varieties of English, but it seems like we could talk about those again. But I think, you know, coming back to the bilingualism, it's a complex issue, and then all of these other social justice features, I don't know the right term, that come along with it and have to be considered in order for it to be a program that can deliver on some kind of equity promise as well as the language promise.
So are we ready to? Oh, no.
Is there?
Are we ready to wrap up? Okay.
I've been told end.
The end.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
That we don't demand better ways of assessing what we're doing, because it certainly is possible to create these if we demanded them, but we've not done that, and we've been willing to just say they're doing well in English, they're doing well. Okay, so we've come in on time. I am supposed to remind you, right, Lori, that with respect to tomorrow morning, if you will check out before you come over, if you're spending the night over in the Luskin Center, so that you can depart right from here and don't have to go back during the day. Are there other things I need to tell folks?
We just want to say that they're going to set up for dinner, and then we're going to have dinner at Spiker.
Yeah, so do they have to leave the room?
No, but they're going to be getting out.
Yeah.
You might
want
to stretch your legs.
What's that? Yeah, stretch your legs, and there's also a coffee area out there. So 5:30
dinner.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
you.
Thank
you. Thank
you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do that.
I'm going to go to the next one. It's a fun thing. People are Hey, Guadalupe, how are you?
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
I'm still banning those paragraphs. I'm so happy.
We
have to ban that. Exactly, right. Yeah.
But you know, it's hard to know sometimes because we were already going to put in legislation, you know, to put the California Spanish Assessment Committee accountability system, and then we got all this pushback, right?
And Kenji and I were involved in it.
Right, and then, you know, we were like, well, everybody's not sure they want to do it.
So as much as I am completely happy with the Spanish testing too, we do have to find some balance.
Well, we came up with the schema, and then they took it to the technical design committee, and they kiboshed it. And so we said, you know, why don't we have a continuum, one for English learners and one for native speakers.
Well, that has
some measurement. And we said, okay, so the native Spanish speakers should be taking the test in Spanish until they reach the next level of English proficiency, and then they could take it in French the same way for the English speakers, and you know, they have to knock them out. So I mean, we just don't have any way to get consensus or even buy-in
from the legislature.
No, we could probably get it through the legislature.
Yeah, it's a profession. The professional community arguing about too many things as well.
Right. So, unless we have support in the field, we're not going into the legislature. Well, we're a statewide organization, so we have to. Well, 4 times a year we meet with, the state meets 4 times a year with all the county English learners. And they have the 15 districts with the largest English learner population that sit in that meeting also. And they have teachers. So we host a luncheon. So 4 times a year we have them for lunch. And so county people take the stuff back to their districts and then they tell us what is there. So we're having that conversation. And we couldn't get. So we said, well, the other thing is, we don't know if, you know, they field tested the Spanish test, we don't know the results. Maybe they're bad.
No, we never heard anything bad. ETS.
But the state.
The state actually commissioned. I was still on the ETS board of trustees, and I got a dispensation to support one of the consultants on it, along with me. So we had hours on the elevator. Was it going to come to anything? Was it not? Was it going to be sealed by losing or anything? But with the questions you told me, that certainly we didn't do some of these things that were asking for standardized language and standardized language. But you get into all of that stuff, right? So are we really testing literacy? Are we really testing whatever somebody's idea is of what good is? We run into all of that also.
So it's developed.
And
they feel tested.
It's a compromise. I haven't seen the final thing. Consulting at the beginning, and then they basically, there's a lot of politics, and our job is to say, first question.
So what we want to do, is get somebody, cut the use of somebody, to ask the state for the results of the Spanish test, and for those who didn't see their results out. Because if we find out that
except for that, if you know that in the program,
I understand, but that would be a big political. We would have to think about that because people want that out, right? So we could find out and then we could tell people to do a test system without making it in the accountability system and having a reward system.
So much because what people normally do is if she gets a good test, she gets measured in something right. And so they could be doing better in English than Spanish because the test in Spanish is better. Even if going forward, I mean, I really don't think that the LPAC is going to serve us well. They did it, and then they called us and yelled to Bob and Quanti and to Kenji Hakuta and others, and I lost. Basically said, why are we doing systemic functions of linguistics? Right? Nobody knows what a verb is, but that would be good, because the person writing it was very different. So I don't know. I lost. It got me. It went forward. Very few changes were made. And then, but all of that is fiction, right? There is no empirical data underneath those standards. There's two questions again. You could actually have a longitudinal study of kids before children being probably developed, or you could somehow or the other go find data on language development in some other way. So you have neither. But that's how they understand. People in the room. People in the room. What are the intermediates doing?